Let's do this.
What is virtualization?
You're gonna learn today.
Innovate like a startup, deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeeed up and ready because it's gonna be a great day.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Oh yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Lero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 61. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Arrow, and joining me once again is my partner in crime, Mr. John Nicholson. John, how you doing, buddy?
Good.
Well, John, as you know, we're always asking our listeners to send us requests at podcast@vmware.com, and several folks have asked us to do an episode on storage networking. So I reached out to one of the industry experts in this field, and he was gracious enough to respond and come and chat with us today. So I'm pretty excited about that. How about you, John?
I'm digging this. This is going to be a lot of fun.
And so let's bring this guy on. He's from Cisco. He is a data center technologist working in the office of the CTO. He's got his own blog at jmetz.com, and you can find him on Twitter at drjmetz.com. Coincidentally, his name is Jay Metz. Jay, welcome to the podcast.
I know. It's amazing how that works together. How you doing?
Hey, before we even dive into storage networking, I wanted to tell you, I love your blog. I've been reading your blog for a little bit. You've got some, you don't just talk about one specific technology. I love the fact that you talk about philosophy, academia, all different types of things. So I just wanted to commend you.
Yeah, it's very eclectic.
Yeah, yeah. And
thank you. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Yeah. You recently had a blog post on thick and thin skinned people as an example. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a departure. I haven't written something like that in a very long time, but because it was more personal than normal. Usually I go for the philosophical stuff that's rather generic, but this one I brought a lot of personal stuff into it.
I like it.
Yeah, something new, something different.
Yeah. So aside from blogging, Jay, tell us, what's a day like for Jay Metz at Cisco? What do you do there?
Well, I kick back in my pajamas. I drink a couple cups of coffee, cigarette dangling from my lips. And I just basically watch the soap operas. Actually, no, what I do is I spend an awful lot of my time doing evaluations of new technologies, the kind of stuff that's going to come out in about, 2 to 5 years. I work on the board of directors for several different storage industry associations. So I'm on the board of directors for NVMe. I'm on the board of directors for SNIA. I'm on the board of directors for Fibre Channel. So I basically spend my day in, day out, storage and storage networking. It's what I do, God help me, but it's what I do.
Yeah. And so I guess the first question, John, don't you think would be Fibre Channel over Token Ring? Is this the future?
Well, it's certainly the past. It actually was a proposal for a spec for an April Fool's Day back in 2006 or 2005. Most people don't know that. They thought it just came up out of a drunken storage graybeard conversation, but it actually was put forth in the T11 as a proposal.
Wait, someone actually put a wow. They actually submitted it.
Well, it wasn't serious. It was an April Fool's thing, but the thought had been put. But it was all laid out. The technical specs were all there. How it would work. I thought it was hilarious.
I think it was Howard Marks that started that joke, but he's the one that told me about it.
That's right. Yeah, and then Steve Foskett put on the pins and everything.
Yeah, I've got my pins somewhere around the house, so.
I have a lot of just Salt IT pins.
Nice.
Yeah. So, I mean. Getting into on a more serious note of, discussing, let's start, I guess, with networking. Kind of I see two sides of that. We've got storage networking, which we'll get to, but just general in-rack networking. I've been guilty of accusing networking of being boring. It's just, an argument between ECMP or leaf spine and OSPF. But it looks like we've got a lot of different technologies here that are kind of on the cusp of potentially breaking out. Where do you see that going?
Are we talking about from a networking perspective specifically or from a storage perspective?
From a networking, from a transport layer. So Ethernet, which is obviously keeps winning out, even if it's maybe not the best. I secretly was championing for InfiniBand back in the day. But, things in rack like PCI Express switch communications, Intel Lightpeak, some of these other, there's a micro something or other. Do you see any of these actually, disrupting or challenging Ethernet in a significant way?
Well, you'll have to remember that Ethernet is effectively a general purpose network. That's what it was designed to be, and that's the way it's been put into place. And so as a general purpose network, it has a pretty wide sweet spot. It can handle a lot of different types of traffic at the same time. That's what makes it a very appealing and comfortable network to choose. Ethernet doesn't necessarily solve all the world's problems, however. There are certain things that Ethernet just simply can't do for either physical reasons or through, you know, software reasons. And that's where other types of networks have, you know, risen and fallen over time. When they've tried to make different types of dedicated networks into general ones, they've almost always failed. And the reason is not always just because of technology. Sometimes it has to do with the layer 8 problems, a management problem, or a personnel problem. One of the reasons why InfiniBand didn't quite make it from a general purpose networking approach was that the skill sets were just too radically different for the kind of general purpose needs that people were looking for. You know, Fibre Channel was the same way. Fibre Channel was a dedicated storage network. You could have run IP over it. And that was a very appealing thing back when Fibre Channel was running at 2 gig and Ethernet was running at 100 megabit.
I vaguely remember there was a spec for that, IP over FC. I think it was from the Windows 2003 era. And so, yeah, it was, I don't think I ever saw it actually deployed, but I mean, it was a thing.
Oh, it was. It was deployed. There was a company called Nishon a long time ago that used to sell IP over FC. You know, it was a good technology. It was a good product. And, you know, the problem was that the flexibility of Ethernet really won out in that kind of, you know, tete-a-tete, right? So, you know, if you're looking for one kind of network to be able to handle good enough, Ethernet pretty much is the way to go.
All right.
It just so happens that good enough also winds up being really wicked fast right now. That's the key thing.
Yeah, well, the 200 gig Ethernet and the RDMA, you know, capabilities being added through Rocky and IWARP, that stuff is outpacing InfiniBand in some cases, it looks like.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, we're actually talking about 400 gig Ethernet, you know, in the industry at this point in time. It's still relatively rare, but you know, that's the, you know, that the eye on the prize is certainly not what people are deploying right now. It's moving far into the future. There's even conversations about, you know, terabit Ethernet, but that's way down the road.
One thing that was interesting to me is how long, and a lot of outside of large enterprises, how long that transition from 1 gig to 10 gig was. Do we think that's these future transitions from 10 to 25, 25 to 100 and so forth? Do you think we're going to accelerate on this? Do you know, commodity ASICs or some of the capabilities behind, you know, or some of the market force behind that, we're going to see a faster transition than we did from 1 to 10?
I think so, because what's happening is that you actually have more competition now. So the people are having to be forced into areas outside of their comfort zones. And we're not just talking about, you know, 10 to 40 to 100 or 25 to 50 to 200. We're also talking about slower speeds like 2.5 and 5. And the reality is that we are creating better granularity for running different types of traffic. And so I think what's going to wind up happening is that the transition isn't really so much as to faster and faster. It's to what is the best fit for the needs that you have. And I think that's actually a good transition to have, because it makes us re-examine what our needs really are, as opposed to saying, well, I got a choice. I got 1 gig or I got 10 gig. Oh, look, I got 40 gig. Great. Now everything's going to go faster, right? Well, what do you mean it doesn't? You
know, it doesn't. Kind of, yeah, at the range. Or that was one thing that was really interesting to me. I remember hearing someone say, I think it was on 10 gig or maybe it was 100 gig, to where like 90% of the engineering time and cost was getting the last like 10%, making sure it could match the previous meter distance of the last spec by, yeah, you know, 10%. You end up with these really weird economic costs associated with, well, the last spec hit 300 meters, so this has to hit 300 meters. And that's the 2.5 and 5 are really interesting for campus wireless deployments, because one modern AC gear can push past 1 gig. But running 10 gig, because of the distance limitations often associated with 10 gig, and particularly 10 gig with PoE, I mean, isn't that where the 2.5 and the 5 gig spec has come from?
Well, I mean, the question really winds up being is that, well, if I've got these massively, you know, wide bands, am I using it all for the amount of work that I have to push across the network? So if I got Wi-Fi speeds, do I really need a 10 gig link between the actual endpoints? And the answer is often no, because the wireless itself can't really push that data through the pipe. So you're not looking at that kind of throughput on the wire, which, by the way, really winds up being a cost question. So the thing is that I can run 2.5 and I can run 5 and I can even run 10 on, you know, RJ45s, Cat6, Cat6A, Cat7, those kinds of things, which are a lot cheaper than running optical transceivers. And so now the cable plant is the main deciding factor for what we're looking to do, because cabling can be a very expensive proposition. And if you're not able to push that kind of throughput, like 10, 40, whatever, then why would you want to spend the money on the transceivers and the optics to do it, especially if you just don't have that ability?
Well, and even if the transceivers and optics are free, you still have to go run that plant. And so particularly in a school, if you've already got all this Cat 6 or Cat 5E specifically everywhere, and you've already got the existing distances run, something that, you know, doubles or, you know, 5X is your speed, but you don't have to go. It kind of reminds me of the problem of getting fiber to my house.
Right.
90% of that is not the switching. It's not the optics. It's the guys going out and digging.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and getting that initial conduit in, and then subsequent cable pulls are easy and cheap. So, no, that's an interesting concept. But that shows on the campus side, we're trying to reuse stuff as possible. And the data center, I see kind of two schools of thought. People who kind of slowly iterate their data center, try to leverage that, versus a lot of people who build something, run it for 5 years, and then build something next to it, migrate, and light the old thing on fire. So do you think the data center will move at different speeds, or will have more general purpose connectivity? Or
It's very difficult to answer that question. I think one of the things we have to remember is that the variety of deployments is so wide and varied. It's very difficult to say that there's going to be a trend one way or the other, because there's always going to be a need for specific topologies based upon geographical locations. It's just not easy to say.
Well, let me ask you this then. So traditionally, you see, you know, storage systems that were the bottleneck, right? And then as people start to upgrade storage, their storage systems with flash, NVMe, et cetera, do you see the trend moving, like the bottleneck moving more towards networking? And then if so, what are the solutions to that?
Well, technology transitions are always a game of whack-a-mole. And realistically, for the last several decades, you know, the mole has always been storage to whack,
right?
So the thing is that because of the fact that storage was so slow compared to everything else, compared to CPUs, compared to caching, compared to networking, it was very easy to say, let's just throw the data over the wall and let the storage do its own thing. And then we're going to process our own stuff and then wait for the storage to get back to it when it can. Now, all of a sudden, we're finding out that we're having to rethink not only the network, but also the relationship to the CPUs as a result of it. And yeah, things are going to change quite a bit, which means that anybody who is involved in storage or networking or compute is going to have to be far more aware of their ancillary technologies. So for example, if you happen to be a virtualization guy, you need to know more about networking. If you are a storage guy, you need to know more about networking. If you're a networking guy, you need to know more about virtualization as well as the storage. So you've got to expand your horizons to the flanking technologies that are going to affect your day-to-day life. It's going to be a big problem as we start to move beyond replicating what we currently do into doing new things. So there are some pretty interesting things that are going on with storage in particular, as storage starts to overlap into memory space. And I know you've had that conversation with a couple of other previous guests, but it's very real, and it's a very real concern that people should be paying attention to. And in order not to get behind the curve and, you know, underneath the wave as opposed to riding on top of it, I really do think that people should start getting familiar with how basics of things like storage actually work, or storage networking for that matter.
Well, and I feel like for a while there, I was personally just moving away from concerning myself with the internal latencies of level 3 cache, or you know, what the actual seek times of NVDEMs were versus an NVMe drive versus that. But this is actually right. It's all becoming more relevant. And I'll actually give a shout out for Frank Deneman and Niels's book, The Host Resource Deep Dive, because they really go into a lot of they kind of bring back that hardware nerd like level credit in their latest book. But it's NVDIMMs are really interesting, because this whole concept of persistent memory, I mean, this goes back to the mainframe era, and now you have something that's wildly faster than even, you know, PCIe potentially.
Well, I mean, yes, it is, but I think the real golden nugget here is not the speeds and feeds, because NVMe, NVDIMMs, all that kind of stuff are going to be wicked fast. We know that. That's not really a surprise. What is going to take people by storm, however, is the fact that we're changing the model of the relationship between devices. In other words, if we think of it horizontally, that's the word that I use to think of the components in line from a CPU to its end storage device, whether it's a PCIe or an Ethernet network or a fiber channel network or any of that kind of stuff, then all really what you're doing is just simply lining up your shots and you're trying to figure out how these different pieces connect. But that's a one-to-one relationship that we've been used to for 20, 30, 40 years. What happens if it becomes a many-to-many relationship? In other words, many storage devices relating to many host cores at the same time. And it's the question no longer is how interesting is NVDIMMs or which model of memory are you choosing or what the latency is or what the seek times are. It's now the issue is how many of these things are doing it at the same time. And how do you negotiate the scale, which previously was done at the thousands and thousands of nodes, now being done internally to each individual core, especially if you're going to be managing that over a network. So all of these different things, the relationships between the end devices become the real concern for people who have only really had to deal with one in, one out.
Well, and at what point are we going to start seeing more of this disaggregation of compute from the internal components? This, I guess Intel had the rack scale discussion where you have your tray of CPUs and your tray of memories and your tray of storage and have kind of a many-to-many relationship across some type of backplane.
It's a question really of trade-offs, right? So the thing is that the rack scale architecture that Intel was putting together was heavily dependent upon the interconnects between devices. So that if you had a rack which had all these different components, where you could put in any compute and put in any storage and put in any memory, and then basically it would all magically put together. The magic is in the network. And the network needs to be extremely low latency and extremely high bandwidth, especially as you start getting into these upper level NVMe type expectations. The problem that Intel has had is that interconnects are hard. I mean, network, it's hard.
Yeah. That's
you know, for sure. Because but then again, so is storage, right? So there's, The big problem I see that a lot of IT people have is, well, we do the hard part. We're the ones that do all the work, and we just hand it off to the people who just floated across the network. They're not really doing anything, you know. And I think that kind of limited view is going to be painful for some people to undo.
Oh yeah.
Well, I mean those high speed, wasn't that what HPE was working with Silicon Photonics for the longest time? I mean, still haven't seen that out of the lab. And gosh, they've been working on that for 20 years or something. So that type of capabilities. And as we keep the challenges when you try to build those interconnects, everything above it just keeps getting faster. So the demand on the network keeps getting faster. So getting something out of the lab into production, I can see why that's kind of drug on for a while.
Well, because the issue is that what science projects and production are two completely different problems to solve. With a science project, you're trying to make it work. And with production, you're trying to break it. When I'm talking in terms of how you test it and how you make sure that your measurement for success and failure, they're radically opposite viewpoints. And so what may work very well in a science project or in a lab, you know, is all about how delicate the nature of the relationships between the components are. The more delicate it is, the more complex it is, the more difficult it is to maintain in a production type of environment, because it doesn't do you any good if it doesn't work. And so that's where the Silicon Photonics issue has been the most problematic up until this point in time, because now you're getting into things like materials, you're getting into quantum mechanics, you're getting into light, you're getting into optics, you're getting into electrics versus electricity versus optical connections, and those are the kind of nuances and subtleties that can make a huge difference in the long run, especially when you start talking about putting them into interchangeable, hot pluggable, composable systems. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not going to be possible. In fact, I've seen some technologies that look like they're going to be extremely promising because the resiliency has just been improved by an order of magnitude. But it's not going to happen by the end of this year. It won't happen by the end of next year. I'd be very surprised if it happened by the end of the decade. But it will happen eventually.
Yeah.
This is actually reminding me of an article I read about the iPhone 10, which I have on order here. And just the sheer amounts of hell they had on manufacturing the optics for the sensor kit based on the miniaturization they were trying to do. And that's nothing, you know, relative to some of these type of interconnect challenges here. But, you know, they were talking about just trying to get above a 50% yield at manufacturing and make that to where it's repairable, replaceable, those units. Yeah, now that I think about it, the whole fact that, you know, if this is on a line card that's got to be slotted out and you've got some, you know, lowest paid labor just slamming it in, like, this stuff could be very fragile when you start getting to the higher ends of physics. So,
yeah, and that's where the materials have to come into play, because the actual materials with which you make them have got to be much more resilient than what we've been, you know, been able to play with.
So material science is the bottleneck on our next generation interconnects. I like that.
Yeah, you're going to have to get somebody from MIT labs or something to get in here.
Well, I'm curious, but, you know, I know we're not going to speak specifics on futures, but as we look to the future of storage networking, what do you think, whether it's protocols or any other technologies that seem to be losing their steam and not really fitting into the future of storage networking?
It's very difficult to say with any kind of real prognostication here, because there's always going to be a need for certain types of technology to solve certain problems. I think that we're going to see that technologies that have attempted to move into ancillary or adjacent areas may not get the kind of foothold that they're looking for. For example, I don't see InfiniBand necessarily being the end-all be-all for storage for NVMe. The only real player in the InfiniBand place is Mellanox, and Mellanox has been working with NVMe with using Rocky, right? I mean, they've been promoting their 100 gig NICs for Rocky as opposed to their InfiniBand NICs. So, I mean, unless they've got a marketing decision that I haven't been aware of yet, they don't look like they're pushing InfiniBand as a solution for scalable NVMe storage, even though it's part of the spec. Right. So I think that we're going to see some of that movements. But InfiniBand was never a real storage area network solution. It didn't have the same kind of flexibility that other types of storage have, whether they be Ethernet or fiber channel, just to choose the two main ones. But there's a sweet spot for each of them as well. I just don't think that particular technology is going to necessarily be a strong contender for adoption in the future. Now, that's not to say that InfiniBand as a interconnect is going to be good, because it will. It's people are still going to be using InfiniBand for IPC. That's where its sweet spot really is. It just may not be for storage. So I think that you're going to wind up with a slightly greater fragmentation for the different types of storage technologies that will solve certain problems. For example, we have block, file, and object types of storage. And I always get a little bit sensitive whenever I hear somebody say that, X technology is dead or Y technology is going away, because my technology will solve all of the problems except for the ones that it won't. I mean, I have mad respect for hyperconvergence. My company sells a hyperconvergence product. You're familiar with the hyperconvergence products, but hyperconvergence does not solve all the particular problems that we have in a data center. Right. There's a reason why all flash arrays, more than 80% of all flash arrays, are connected to fiber channel networks. There's a reason for that. Mm-hmm. And it has nothing to do whatsoever with how cool the technology is. The reality is that there's a reason why we do these kinds of things. So I think that you're going to have a need for storage networks that are dedicated. You're going to have a need for storage networks that are not dedicated, that are basically non-deterministic. And it's all going to depend upon whether or not your particular requirements are going to fall into one or the other. I try to recommend to people not to make the decision before they get the information. One of the phrases that I use, and I learned a long time ago, I wish I could take credit for it, is prescription before diagnosis is malpractice. And nowhere is that true inside of technology like it is true inside of storage. Because when you lose storage, you lose everything.
Oh yeah.
If your storage goes down, you lose your company. You lose your job. You will sit in front of a Senate committee explaining why you don't have the data that they were regulated to have, right? If you lose a virtual machine, you don't have the same kind of threat. So nowhere in this case is going to be more important for people to realize that simply because of the fact that a new technology is coming out, whether it be NVMe or, silicon photonics or phase change memory, spin torque, whatever it winds up being, there's no such thing as a magic bullet to solve all your problems.
Yeah.
And going back to kind of that theme of good enough for Ethernet, or, in a lot of ways, I've always said HCI, hyperconverged infrastructure, it's often kind of gone for that. It started with that good enough approach and it's kind of expanded out. Looking at the storage networking, I mean, we've got, Ethernet with Rocky kind of in one corner, and then we've got Fibre Channel as our two main networks that are in the data center today. Where is the future application of Fibre Channel? I mean, it's got some things going for it in terms of, it's designed for, you don't have to deal with spanning tree or loops without doing exotic overlays.
Mm-hmm.
It was designed for that A-B isolation type separation for high change control environments, things like that. Mm-hmm. You've got that operational separation benefits, which that's a reason beyond the technology why it may stick around. But the other challenge is, my understanding is, Fibre Channel for general ASICs, all you've got left is Broadcom making them. So how is it going to get that? So are there other players there?
Oh, yeah. So Broadcom is one, and Cavium is another. Those are the two main ASIC manufacturers for endpoint fiber channel connectivity. Cavium purchased QLogic and Broadcom purchased Emulex. And so the two main adapter vendors were absorbed by those two companies.
Oh, I'm talking the switch side, because I know Broadcom bought Brocade, which had the switch ASICs, and I thought the MDS is OEM that, or there was some.
No,
weird...
well, no, not the MDS. The MDS runs its own silicon. Okay. Some of the Nexus platforms do run Broadcom ASICs, but some of it is also Nexus. So the Nexus ASIC is actually, there's different Nexus product lines use different ASICs, and the functionality may be similar across them, but they all do other things too. So you have dedicated ASIC development for specific product lines.
Okay, so we've still got diverse ASIC development, so Fibre Channel can continue on.
Right. Well, but the other thing to keep in mind is that where something is processed inside of an ASIC is not the whole story. And one of the reasons why, you know, to the original part of your question is that when you start to look at storage as an end-to-end holistic solution, you have a very different type of question that you need to have answered. Where does the reliability and availability come from, for instance? Is it spread out across the stack, or is it in any particular part of the stack? For instance, in a non-deterministic system that we use for iSCSI, for example, where we're using TCP/IP, we don't rely on a centralized knowledge of what's going on inside of the network to maintain the consistency across the board for your storage. We let the upper layer protocols handle retransmissions, for instance. You know, the negotiation between the endpoints and the devices are that. It's the negotiation between the endpoints and those devices. In Fibre Channel, it's a different system. It's a deterministic system, which means that every device in the entire fabric is aware of what's going on, especially the switches. You share that information across every single switch. And that alone means that you've got a centralized approach to understanding what's going on across the entire network. That's not what happens inside of a large Ethernet environment. It's not even what happens inside of a small iSCSI environment. You don't necessarily know what's going on in the network at any given point in time, but you can inside a Fibre Channel. So that visibility makes a huge difference to certain types of applications as well as administration needs. Management becomes a huge issue. Qualification becomes an issue. You know, right now you can't put a Rocky endpoint on a host and an iWarp endpoint on a target, even though they're both RDMA, and it won't work. They just don't work together. But it's still RDMA. Okay, well, what about Rocky? Well, we've got Rocky V1 and we've got Rocky V2. All right, which version are you going to use? And which vendors are going to be able to do this? Which management tools are going to be doing this? Which admins are used to running storage using RDMA? So there's more to it than just being able to say that I've got an ASIC that can process the bits. You know, if all I was doing was just moving bits across the wire, then that would be easy to do.
Yeah.
But how are you going to discover the endpoints? You know, discovery becomes a major issue. Rocky doesn't have a standardized approach for doing that. The NVMe group is working on an approach for discovery at this point in time. But even as it begins to emerge, it doesn't have the kind of longevity and maturity that you'd find in a, you know, FSPF type of network in Fibre Channel.
Well, it's I'm thinking of the storage layer you had for ICE, because you had what, ISNS was the discovery system.
Mm-hmm.
Although I didn't always see it leveraged very often, but
exactly. And what's the reason why?
I was going to say a lot of ICE because the environments were small, so it just wasn't viewed, mm-hmm, I guess, as critical. But that's an interesting point. And that was actually one kind of worry I have with Rocky, and I, you know, is that it was going to mirror kind of some of the same faults of FCOE. In that, or you know, the trill versus short path bridging, that rather than take the best of Ethernet with it, which has, you know, historically been its commodity, general interoperability, and instead try to make it into something it's not and make it very proprietary, very, you're only going to want one vendor end to end on this, and you're going to have to be really consistent. So I guess, are we seeing this stuff required to get, you know, Ethernet-based and Rocky-based fabrics, you know, out of the lab and into general production? Is that going to require vendor tools for configuration, or are there more extensions to the spec?
Well, there actually, it's funny you should say that. There's a webinar on November 7th for NVMe management interface, and it's done by two of the guys who've written the spec themselves. It's being handled by the NVMe Express group. I would defer that question to finding out from that particular webinar, because they can go into far greater detail than I can. I'm afraid I'm a management wannabe more than anything else. But yes, I think that you're going to have different types of solutions, and some of them are going to be everything is behind the scenes, and you're going to run some sort of software-defined solution as it's presented in marketing speak, that is. But your trade-off is going to be lower performance, right? So you're going to get NVMe, but you're not going to get the kind of NVMe that you may be expecting if you're going to have it all managed up at a really high abstraction layer. I think what's going to happen, and I think where your question is really going towards, is when are these different technologies going to be most likely applied? And I think that, if I can redefine that question so that I can answer it that way.
That's fair.
I think that the reality is that right now, large storage environments, and I mean like thousands and thousands of nodes, are best handled by Fibre Channel. It's got the better discovery protocols. It's got the best management tools. It's got the best awareness of what's actually happening in the fabric without having to reinvent the wheel. Plus, you can run both SCSI and NVMe at the same time. I think that the Ethernet side of things, whether we're talking about Rocky V2, iWarp, or ICER, or any of that kind of stuff, is more likely to be handled in two different types of ways. Where I think we're going to see in small rack scale environments. I'm using that in the phrase of actually of a scale of a rack as opposed to Intel's rack scale. And I think that we're going to be seeing a lot of componentized high performance compute nodes that are interconnected via a network, meaning that I hesitate to say they're hyperconverged because that's not really what I'm referring to here.
You're talking more like Hadoop or Ceph. Or some type of scale out application stack will be leveraging that. Obviously HCI vendors will adapt Rocky, for that purpose, but also tight application stacks will. One thing to drill back into what you just said, though, is, talking about Fibre Channel strengths across thousands of nodes in those fabrics. The flip side of that, though, is I have seen a trend of some people looking towards, and where possible, trying to break stuff up into not having fault domains at a management or other level span beyond a rack. I mean, you've got the cult of OSPF and leaf spine and networking, as well as just kind of the argument of, I don't want one bug in my fabric, I update the firmware on my HBA and it causes a crash in the fabric. I don't want my blast radius to get that far. So, right. I mean, that lack of scalability in Rocky to that thousands of node scale may not be the worst thing as long as we have automation and tools to at least make the management not painful at scale.
Right. And then you start getting into cap theorem type stuff, right? You're starting to get into whether or not your availability, your performance, and your scalability really winds up being, exactly where you need it to be for the kinds of applications you're looking for. So each model is going to have, you get two out of the three, effectively. You get your management side, you get your performance side, and you get your scale side. And depending upon what your needs are, if you want to have smaller fault domains and you don't need to have that kind of scale, that's fantastic. And I think that that's actually a highly recommended approach because then you can handle each one independently. It's when you have many, many, many of those that you start to realize, well, crap, now I got to manage 100 different environments because they each have 8 nodes as opposed to one environment because it's got 8,000 nodes, right? So that's a management question.
Yeah, and that's where that's kind of interesting because thinking back, I mean, vSphere, for instance, today, the maximum number of nodes in a cluster is 64. Mm-hmm. And people, always ask me, well, how big should I make my cluster? And I go, how many calls can your help desk triage at the same time? If this is a supercomputer in Los Alamos National Labs that one guy is, spinning up 500 nodes, fine. If that thing crashes, he can go reboot it. If I lose, 20,000 VMs because one cluster goes down and I got to go mitigate that or fail over DR or boot that, there starts to be operational scale limits. So as the amount of compute density you can get reaches a certain point, going back to kind of that cap theorem discussion, it starts to be like, how much stuff do I want to be in one blast zone? So shifting the rack to be my cluster or my cluster, my limit barrier for how much isn't the worst thing, I guess.
Remember too, you're talking about a relationship between the host and the end devices or the host and the network in a one-to-one type of a way. Right. So your failure domain, your blast zone that you're talking about with any kind of bug that would interface cannot be contained in an environment where everything is effectively equal and you don't have any kind of alternative failover approach.
Code bugs are global still is the problem, no matter how much hardware resilience
if you have a code bug in your Fibre Channel switch, you're going to have a problem. You're absolutely right. And that's one of the reasons why we still have people who have never updated the code on their Fibre Channel switches.
Oh, you don't do the staggered reboots, so that way the time bomb bugs won't hit both fabrics. You keep different patch levels, like wildly different patch levels between the fabrics.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And the limitations of each technology have to be understood from their best practices perspective. And you're not going to get away from that from either side.
You know, my dream, like as a fiber channel admin, would have been an HBA that had the A path use one ASIC and one firmware and the B path use another and like do it all in one card somehow. Because I wasn't worried about the internal PCIe connector. But
no, I amen, brother.
That would have been hell to manage. But, you know, it would have been but of course, that's also I'd say why
ASIC. It would have been a very expensive card, but sure.
Yeah, well, to give you know Cisco some love here, managing those underlays, managing those types of components and that stuff within the server. I mean, that's what UCS has been had a great strength is delivering that type of holistic management at scale. You know, of granular pieces as well as managing multiple you know different silos. So,
right.
Another quick question here. I know we're probably coming up on the end of time, but just for fun here, NVMe over Fabric. So NVMe, as we talked about with the previous episode, you know, go back, listen to Dave's. You got multiple queues. This opens up some awesome stuff, much fewer interrupts, much better CPU. You know, SCSI, it's really, we've drugged this thing out for a long time. That said, I'm seeing, you know, iSCSI RDMA extensions, ICER. I'm seeing, in theory, there's a spec for NVMe for NFS, although that I expect to be like PNFS and never be a real standard. Is there still life in the traditional iSCSI and NFS protocols by, you know, bolting, you know, a rocket onto that dinosaur and giving it, you know, RDMA? Or do you expect NVMe, you know, over Ethernet or anything just to displace SCSI pretty quickly?
Well, I doubt that we're going to have any kind of real replacement for SCSI anytime soon. The amount of different technologies that SCSI talks to and with is far greater than what NVMe does. I'm afraid I don't know anything about the NVMe NFS thing. There's nothing in the technical working group for NVMe.
RDMA for NFS was.
Oh, okay. So it has nothing to do with NVMe. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm not familiar with that particular model, but I have a feeling that you're right. Just from off the top of my head, I think that'd probably be a PNFS kind of approach, which I like, by the way. I like PNFS. But the thing is that SCSI talks to so many different types of devices, and that's what we have to keep on remembering here is what is the tool actually used for? You know, SCSI talks to tape, it talks to spinning disks, it talks to archives, it talks to scanners for crying out loud. You know, so the likelihood of SCSI going away is very slim. The likelihood of SCSI being replaced by NVMe for different types of tier one and tier zero applications is pretty high. However, if you're looking at object storage, and you're looking at massive disaster recovery types of environments where the WAN links are really your limitation at that point in time, as opposed to the spinning disks.
Yeah, who cares about multiple queues at that point if it's right. You know, 50 milliseconds? The seek time is improving the local seek time on the device is not going to matter.
Exactly. And so I think what we're going to find out is what we said at the very beginning of the show, which is that we have greater degrees of granularity for solving the problems with a better defined tool set.
Yeah.
And I think what we're going to find out is that the tool set for SCSI has been extended to the point where certain parts of it can be replaced, but certain parts cannot. And I think that when we start to I don't know if you've seen the LTO5 specification for tape, but it's really impressive. The amount of capacity that you can put onto an LTO5 tape is phenomenal. And the access time is really impressive as well. So I think what we're going to find is that we'll see this granularity start to even itself out in actual implementations. And the today's tier zero is tomorrow's tier one. You know, that kind of stuff is going to be natural as we start to bifurcate the production types of environments where, you know, certain types of you know, sub nanosecond persistent memory is replacing the cache, which is currently volatile. And once we do that, we're going to see different movements into the capacity side. And what's load store versus what's IO is going to make a huge difference. And I think, yes, in that particular regard, maybe SCSI is not going to be your main go-to type of environment.
So tape is not dead yet.
Oh, dude, tape is what I'm waiting for is the tape robot tape library to support NVMe over Fabrics. And then it takes the multiple queues and sends them each to a different drive.
I'm waiting for Alexa to be the tape drive. Alexa, change my tapes.
Let me give you one little quick thing about the tape thing. So a couple of years ago, I went to a geographic seismic research institute, and they had 150 exabytes of seismic data on tape. They have so much information from geothermal research on tape that they have bought their own boats They have their own shipping fleet to do this kind of research. And they do this all day, every year.
Wow.
Tape is not going away. If for no other reason, that company will produce tape to do its seismic data. And we're talking exabytes and exabytes of data for that one company, that one particular use case. Tape is not going away.
Hmm. Well, listen, we're coming up on the end of this episode, but Jay, we could probably talk to you for about 3 hours on 20 different topics. This is an invitation to come back anytime you want. Just looking at your blog, I could pull about 6 different topics that we could probably dive into. So yeah, I would love for you to come back one day and just nerd out with us, maybe even on stuff like flash. What's the best type of flash? What are some of the differences? You know, how to avoid data loss, things like that. So I would love to have you come back in and nerd out with us if you're interested.
Absolutely. Just let me know.
Awesome. Hey, John, anything else before we land this plane?
It's time for me to go close my skill gap on all these technologies because we're not going to get them into the data center, you know, and out of the lab if I don't actually start learning, you know, what more of these acronyms mean. So
yeah.
All right. Until next week.
All right, well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. Subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this and all episodes at vspeakingpodcast.com. A huge thanks to Mr. J. Metz for joining us today and geeking out. We will see you next week. And until then, bye for now.
Prescription before diagnosis is malpractice.
I am profoundly dumbfounded.
The big problem I see that a lot of IT people have is, well, we do the hard part. We're the ones that do all the work, and we just hand it off to the people who just floated across the network, not really doing anything.
Storage is cool.
Oh, yeah.
Winning.
Enough of this jibber jabber.